Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and this is a highlights compilation, but not any highlights compilation. It is a huge show. Over the last few weeks, I've been lucky enough to have three absolutely massive conversations with Danny Sheehan, Chris Ramsey, and Richard Dolan. All three went into some fascinating territory, and the numbers and reaction from all of you proved that as much. It was blown away. I really was. So for this one, I've pulled together some of the biggest moments, strongest claims, and most interesting exchanges from across those interviews into one highlights compilation. These have been really popular on the video formats, and I know a lot of folks on the audio formats enjoy these too. So whether you caught the full shows or missed them first time round, there's a lot in here. We're going to get into it first with Richard Dolan, move on to Danny Sheehan, and then finally, Chris Ramsey. Any sponsors or ads you listen to during the show are much appreciated. It all goes towards supporting myself and the podcast. Anyway, let's get straight into it with Mr. Richard Dolan. Well, I'm going to take us back to 1948. take us back to simpler times in some ways. On your review of Drop 3, because I hate that word tranche and everyone keeps using it. Hard to say. You talked about a file DOW UAP D086. For those of you following along with the buzzword bingo, rolls off the tongue. And I'm bringing this up because I did read, after being prompted to go and look at some stuff.
Which one is that?
This is the file that you talked about, where it was from the Commandant of the 5th Naval District to activities indicated in distribution list, subject flying discs. And it's essentially a report about patterns and new appearances of flying saucers, right? And for those who hadn't seen it, and I do recommend checking out Richard, I'm going to read you very briefly some of the stuff here, okay? So from the Chief of Naval Operations, they said, subject flying discs report of. Number one, the Director of Intelligence, US Air Forces, has informed the Navy Department that a cycle of reappearance of flying discs is becoming apparent. Now, that language is interesting, and that the beginning of a new interval is imminent. They have requested that any such sightings be reported as quickly as possible and these phenomena be investigated. It's also requested, therefore, all stations be directed to report to the nearest Air Force Command. But just that first bit, Richard, around informed the Navy that a cycle of reappearance of flying discs is becoming apparent, and that the beginning of a new interval is imminent. Now, that was interesting. That was pointed out to me before I'd watched your review, to go and have a look at that. And even if you look at one of the other files, DOW UAP D088, there's an older file that gets into pattern hunting, and it's actually a civilian correspondence, and it links strange reports to the moon positions, cycles from Venus. And bear in mind, we're going back here to the early 1900s, folks. Earlier airships or saucer-style reports. But again, it's speculation, not an Air Force conclusion, but they are receiving reports on this and looking at it. This idea of patterns and cycles, I think, is a really, really interesting one. And I'd love to get your take on this, because I've got some questions for you around how this potentially changes how we should look at the entire subject of ufology, if indeed there is a cycle and pattern to these things.
Yeah, I'm very glad you brought this up, because it struck me as quite significant as well. The very fact that by the late 1940s, this is early days, that you have analysts within, and I didn't catch this, by the way, 30 plus years ago when I was researching this period for the first time. I was going through some Freedom of Information documents and some research, but I didn't know about this particular file. But what you see is that you had very serious military intelligence analysts seeing, as you just noticed, patterns in flying saucer reports and in waves of flying saucers. So that tells us this was absolutely seen as a national security concern, these flying discs, despite the fact that even by the late 40s, they were already being dismissed by the establishment as ridiculous nonsense and juvenile, you know, foolishness. But they were taking it very seriously and looking for patterns. And we, by the way, those documents don't tell us what those patterns are. Mm. So we don't really get that. But there, But, you know, looking at the history, early history of these of sightings, as I have studied them, you get waves of sightings that happen periodically during the late 40s and into the early 1950s that were quite notable, and sometimes were commented on by other officials. In some of the early books that you could read, Captain Edward Ruppelt back in the 50s wrote a very, very fine book on this. And he noted that in 1952, he never really identified who this person was, but a senior person said, yep, we're expecting another wave of sightings. This is 1952. That did indeed occur shortly thereafter. So I just think this release of documents, I just think, you know, if we are willing, as you just did, to look into the deeper meaning of what these documents are saying, you can find it shows a very, very significant national security response to this phenomenon. And that alone ought to cause us to ask questions like, why was the United States government so interested in this in the late 1940s when they were pretending otherwise? Why? And the answer is staring you right in the face. It's because these objects, which did not come from Russia, and there are, by the way, there are studies in this last release that refer to whether or not, you know, could these be from a foreign power? And there is no conclusion, whether in this release or in any release, there is no conclusion in the early years that indicated this was a Soviet project, that the Russians were creating flying saucers and flying them over U.S. territory in sensitive bases. So my point is, you had people looking at that, they were coming up empty. They were still having these reports of mechanical, physical objects in sensitive airspace, and they couldn't figure out who was behind it. And again, within the national security intelligence community, people were coming to the conclusion that this is probably extraterrestrial, because what else could it be? It's not one of our secret projects that we can identify. It doesn't appear to be a Soviet project. Who else is going to be doing this in the late 1940s? The answer is no one. There's no other nation that would be in a position to do this.
So I wonder, am I interpreting this wrong? Or the way I read that is that they almost can predict or know when these things are going to have a wave or a flap, and can almost say, yeah, we're due a wave. It might last a few months. How would they even get to know that these things are about to start appearing? Is that something then is repeatable? I wonder what that says about cycles of behaviors around.
I don't think you misinterpreted it. I think you interpreted that correctly. It does read like that the analysts who were going over this thought, yeah, we're probably in for another cycle. But they don't explain why. That's the frustrating part of that document.
And now we're in this new period of whatever that may be. Is it a final stage of whatever it is they're looking to do? Is it a case we have a phenomenon that comes along, checks us out, and moves on? Because maybe it's a scientific study, or is it something more? Yep. Probably asking you a ton of different, you know, questions or hypotheses there, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think you're moving into a very interesting theory that I probably agree with, which is simply that it's possible that, and it would make sense that any visiting intelligence, if let's say they just arrived in large numbers in the 1940s, I know many people argue, well, they whoever they happen to be, they've been here forever. Well, I don't know who the they is that's been here forever. I do know that the quantity of genuine and good sightings is gone, you know, to orders of magnitude greater since the 1940s. That's undeniable to me. There's some good sightings prior to that, but it really just goes crazy during and after the World War II period. So it would imply that, let's say there's an intelligence that recently arrived, that they're going through a series of protocols and processes that might have included abductions at certain periods. And now, as you say, maybe they're done with that, and they're moving on to different protocols. That's not impossible. However, I would say this. The reason when people say abductions aren't happening more, I'm dubious about that. I don't really know if I believe that. You know, abductions could well have been happening in large amounts back in the 1940s and 50s, but no one was paying attention. No one was studying it. We went through a period where there were several researchers who really threw themselves into the abduction phenomenon. Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and John Mack, those were the big three. They wrote books. They wrote very good books that were great reading, and the subject got a lot of attention. There's, you know, other abduction researchers who also write some books, but they haven't really gotten anywhere near the same amount of attention. People like Yvonne Smith, Kathleen Martin, they do very fine work on abductions in many ways. They're just not getting the attention. But more than that, I don't know if there are any contemporary abduction researchers who are really working the field at all. Every now and then I encounter people who describe to me what surely seems like abduction experiences that happened in the 21st century. So I don't think the phenomenon has stopped. I think that we're just not paying as much attention to it. That's what I suspect. But I don't deny the likelihood of alien adaptive behavior. In fact, I think that they are highly adaptive to the changes in our society. I think they're watching us very carefully, and they are adapting as they need to, because we're not the same society that we were in 1947, not even close. So their behavior has to go through modifications as well, if they want to preserve their own, leeway and their own field of action, which I have no doubt they do. So they would be adaptive to us. But we really are working off of a very limited amount of information, frankly. We'll talk about my USO study a little later, but, you know, I collected close to 700 USO, that is water-based accounts they're fascinating. But I have no doubt there are multiple times that number that I was not able to obtain, that I wasn't able to find. So I don't really know if my data sample is truly reflective of the full gamut of this. I have what I have. It's limited. And I worked hard to get a large data sample. And there's still so much I haven't gotten. So when you have very few people really doing the work of abduction research, well, then you're not going to get much. You're not going to get much data about this. But I would be very hesitant to say, oh, well, people aren't getting abducted anymore. I mean, there's just too many sightings. If you go into the public databases, I'm a big fan of the National UFO Reporting Network, run out of the state of Washington, you know, the West Coast of the U.S. And they'll put out, you know, between 5,000 and 8,000 sightings a year. And a lot of them are someone will wake up at 2 a.m. to go outside and they'll see a dark triangle or a dark object hovering over their neighbor's house. At 100 meters altitude. And so if that's the case, I have to ask, what's that object doing? What's it doing hanging out over someone's home at 2:30 a.m? Well, maybe that's some kind of interaction that's going on. There's a lot of those types of sightings that take place. So I would be very hesitant to argue that there are, you know, abductions aren't happening. What I would say is that abduction researchers are definitely not garnering the attention that they used to. And maybe there aren't as many of them. That's possible.
I think it says to me potentially a few things. One, that the idea of, you know, when, like, if you get your kids a puppy and you've got the adult on the couch and you have the puppy out, who is this little innocent, you know, thing, and you have a kid of quite a young age, and as the adult, you have to watch the kid, make sure they're treating the puppy okay. The kid might be a little bit rough, pick it up, play with it in a way you wouldn't. Have we got this phenomenon that has been here potentially for a long time, maybe moved on, comes back, whatever, but almost they're watching? And then you have other phenomena that come along, which are more like the kids who, for a shorter time, want to play with us, the puppy. They want to give us attention. They want to prod it, poke it, you know, check it out. It's a new thing. It's fun. It's fluffy. You know, how does it work? It's different to us. And then maybe the ones in the background stop it now and again and go, that's enough. maybe the kids just get bored and move on from the puppy, but you've still got the parents in the background kind of watching?
Well, I don't really see a lot of reports that give me the idea that these beings are joyriding or having fun or, you know, screwing around at humanity's expense. I don't really see any of that behavior. What I interpret, I see behavior of objects that are very elusive, that appear to engage in the following types of activities. They appear to be engaged in monitoring. They appear to be engaged in approaching for a certain period of time. They engage in what I've come to call data denial. That is, they have a very excellent ability to disable a lot of our electronics and communications equipment when they want to, or our recording equipment. So they deny us the opportunity to collect data on them while they are presumably collecting data on us. They will approach military assets with regularity, whether American, whether UK, whether Russian, whether Chinese. They approach those military assets. They appear to be extracting data from them. That's what it looks like to me. And then they're gone. So there's not a great desire that I note from these craft that they're in any way interested in having a relationship with us based on equality. I don't get that at all. I get that they are interested in doing what they want to do. They have total command of every situation that they seem to be engaging in. They don't seem to be at a loss. They don't seem to have like these screw ups. I don't see that. If they do, it's not really quite evident to me. So I think they're watching us. Maybe they're calibrating themselves against us. Like what new weapon do these humans have now? And they come and they check that out and maybe decide how do we deal with that if we need to. That's totally possible. But they're not. I don't get the sense personally that they're like there's a group of teenage aliens out there that have to be restrained by mom and dad every so often. Not impossible. It wouldn't be impossible that you'd have rogue elements, I suppose. But I don't really see evidence of that in my observation of it. What I see is very, very controlled, very, I was going to say rational, but maybe I should say very, very controlled. I think they're very controlled and they seem to know exactly what they do and they seem to have no fear of us. They don't seem to be, I don't think they want to interact with us. I think we're probably, why would they want to actually? What a hassle we would be. I mean, this is a good place to talk about this difference between disclosure and contact. I just do not think, based on any behavior that I've ever seen in this phenomenon, that they have the slightest desire to actually communicate with us in an open way. And how could that be done in a way that wouldn't rip our society apart? I think it would not be possible. I think human society, like who would the aliens talk to? They'd talk to Donald Trump. They don't talk to Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, the United Nations. Whoever they talk to, there's going to be an entire group of people that'd be like, what about us? Why that person? Any message I believe that they would have for us would almost certainly be weaponized by all the different factions in our society.
Let's keep it dark. A lot of folks have been talking now for some time, Richard, and I'm sure we must have talked about this on one of our past interviews. I've been lucky to speak to you quite a few times now about this idea of something coming or heading our way, and the dates of 2027 being thrown out. And we've also had 2036. Just the other week, I think, have you been a guest with Lou Elizondo on his tour?
No. I haven't gone.
Okay.
Why?
I know he's thrown out. I know there's a few folks that are heading along. So last week, he had Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp.
Yeah.
And Jeremy asked Lou 5 questions during the tour. On stage, and one of them was around this idea that something is heading our way, potentially in 2027. The whole somber comment that Lou has kind of hung his hat on quite a lot, and he says on the news media and things like that too, he often refers to it and defers the answer to be around people should love their families, love their children, give them hugs. And there is quite a melodramatic tone around his answers. He doesn't go, no, there's nothing to it. I'm curious what you think around this idea that is being peddled, that perhaps we are heading towards an event or a something happening. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I heard about this. I don't know. I'll have to ask him. I don't ever like when people make predictions like this. I always think it's a really bad idea. They never turn true, first of all. They are never, ever true. We've been having predictions in this community since I've been in part of this community for close to 30 years now. And none of them have come true. Not a single one. Whether positive or negative. You know, I remember Ascension in 2012. Oh yeah, that was probably the most cringy, embarrassing moment that lasted several years in this community when people thought, oh yeah, 2012, it's going to change everything. Or then there were people who were convinced that there's an alien craft coming and certain people have created their underground bunkers to protect themselves against it. And just fear, more and more fear mongering. Or predictions. Chris Bledsoe made some predictions for this year. They did not come true.
He moved the dates. He did say Easter, then moved it to October.
Yeah. Well, count me as not a believer. And I like Chris personally. I just don't believe that. I don't believe it at all. So now when Lou goes and says, like, something's coming, is it a ship? Is it this? Is it that? Doubtful. I don't believe it. I'll just say right now, I don't believe these predictions. I think I don't know what's behind his in this case. I think people, you know, we get so wrapped up in our own ideology, our own mindset. I think sometimes we lose perspective. So I don't trust prediction makers if you are making a prediction out of a trend that is happening now and you are trying to extrapolate, that is totally fair. Just, you know, don't pretend that you have the final inside knowledge, that you know something such and such is going to go down on such and such a date. Because really there's, you could, if you really wanted to make a project out of it, someone listening should do this. Just like research all of the failed predictions in the UFO field alone in the last 30 years. Like, you would fill pages and pages and pages. It's embarrassing. So I think ixnay with the predictions peg. No predictions. Stop with the predictions. But the thing is, people are drawn to them. Like, people love predictions.
Yeah.
They can't get enough of it. And it's very unfortunate. That's an easy way to be to get hosed, man. It's an easy way to get taken advantage of.
So, easy way to get hosed. That has to be a cutting to put up for Richard. I don't think I've ever heard you say on your own channel, it's an easy way to get hosed, Richard. So, yeah.
Well, I live with a Canadian, so keep that in mind. They like those expressions.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, that's fair enough. So I'm going to read you one listener question because I'm still going through stuff, but this was one I thought was interesting, and it was from Stumpy on YouTube. Stumpy said, I always feel that Richard Dolan is holding something dark back. He's literally the greatest of all time in this field, but I get the sense at the core of whatever's going on here, it's dark. Not demonic dark, but that we may be dealing with something that is bad, very bad. I don't know if that's a question, but I'm curious what you and him feel about this. It's speculation, but a lot of evidence points to something that doesn't have our best interest in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually kind of spot on. But I think the thing that I see that is dark is, yes, there's reason to think that, A, there are multiple intelligences that are observing and interacting with us. There's reason to think that some of those intelligences are not malevolently disposed toward us. But there is reason to think if you really want to go down into the rumor mill, but sometimes you want to do that, there has been reason to think that maybe one group, at least one group, does not have our interests at heart. I think that's possibly true. But the group that I would be the most afraid of is literally ourselves.
Mm.
I think I'm more afraid of humanity than I am of any visiting group at this point. I think the reason that I have a dark view, and I guess I do, I just have to own up to it, is that I don't really think that we human beings have anywhere near the agency that we think we have, that we have the ability to guide our society in any way that is other than by the force of our technological development. Like we are completely and utterly dependent on the technological society that we have created that gives us more power, gives us longer lifespan, gives us a lot of benefits that we love, right? But we are dependent upon it, and we have essentially divorced ourselves from the rest of the planet in a way that I consider to be very deeply unhealthy. Facts. And then from that, I created a large spreadsheet, which I'd never created a spreadsheet before, and this was a massive one. But I'm so glad I did that, because by seeing those cases laid out that way, I was able to see patterns, and I was able to engage in a kind of analysis. Like at the very beginning of this program, I said my biggest interest in this field is a kind of behavioral analysis of these craft. And this is the reason why, because I was able to study behavioral patterns in these USO craft that I would never have noticed had I not done that legwork. So just so many things. So in this particular volume, so the first volume covers a long period of time from what I consider the earliest legit USO cases up until the end of 1969. So that covers a long period of time. The second volume only covers two decades, the 1970s and the 1980s. That's it. And I think I wrote in the introduction, this period suffers the typical fate of the middle child, you know, because it's the middle volume in the series, and it's easy to get forgotten. But in a lot of ways, the 1970s in particular were an absolutely peak decade of activity for this phenomenon, a mind-blowingly peak activity. I mean, and this is all pre-internet, keep in mind. And still, the largest number of cases that I have been able to collect are from the 1970s. And actually, there was a peak that really went from the late 60s up until the early 80s, but really all of the 1970s. And not only that, so there's a quantity that was really quite shocking to me, but also behavioral changes. So one thing that happened, really it started at the end of the 60s, but by the 70s it was in full swing, and that was a shift of the phenomenon toward predominantly nighttime operations. So prior to the late 60s, of all the cases that I collected, it was almost exactly 50% were in the daytime and 50% were at nighttime. After that, during the 70s, it was 75% were at night. And that goes to almost 90% if you look at military encounters. Military encounters were nearly 90% at night after the late 60s, which is astonishing. So like I look at that and I think, okay, is my data sample large enough? Well, I can't really know for sure. It's large enough that I thought, you know, 700 cases is not completely trivial. And yet this pattern emerged. And I'm thinking, why did that emerge? Why did this go to night? I really wonder if that's the case with aerial cases as well. And I may want to go back and try to review that. There's so many more aerial cases to look into. But nevertheless, I think that something shifted by the early 70s to nighttime operation. Another thing that shifted or increased was cases of electromagnetic interference by these craft, whether of military or civilian boats or, you know, craft, really to an extreme degree. So that a typical situation would be where an object approaches a vessel. Could be American, could be Soviet, didn't matter. It gets close enough and then all the systems go offline. Sometimes, and in some cases, one Soviet case I can think of, the engine This is of a large battle, a large warship. The engine died. The engine of the ship died while the object was nearby. Frequently, communications go down. Frequently, weapon systems go offline. So this phenomenon seemed to know exactly what it was doing. That the sometimes, you know, when you look at cases of electromagnetic interference, we tend to think of it as a kind of residual effect of the craft, not necessarily intentional. But in my study of this, I think that it's very, very much intentional, that the EM is a tool, perhaps you could even say a weapon, but definitely a tool used by them to disable us while they were engaged in observing us in the way that they wished. So they approach, they shut down our systems, and then when they're done, they're done. They just take off and they're gone. This happened so many times. So many times. I really think there's a lot of strong patterns. One of the strongest patterns in the book is this repeated interaction between USOs and military assets. This book is not all military. Most of the cases are still civilian, but aircraft carriers, destroyers, submarines, strategic naval facilities, like these appear again and again and again, not just American, but Soviet. Primarily those two. To me, the pattern suggests much more than accidental encounters. Like, these objects seem very interested in the very systems that represented the most advanced military capabilities of that era, especially nuclear-powered platforms and things like that. So I think there's a lot of reason to believe when you look at the behavior of these USOs that they are engaged in a very careful observation of human technological capabilities. That is what really looks to me. The strongest patterns are definitely behavioral in this. It's like observe, monitor, approach. Like it feels to me like they're testing reactions, occasionally interfering. And then they just leave. I didn't find a lot of evidence of overt hostility, but I didn't find any evidence or hardly any of friendly communication either. So instead, really, the behavior to me resembles, if I had to characterize it, a long-term surveillance and reconnaissance program. Like whatever they are, they don't seem to be interested in introducing themselves to us, but they do seem interested in studying us. So, that and aside from some of the just astonishing cases that blew my mind, those are really the key things that I think I would have to say out of this new book of mine.
In a minute, I'm going to ask you just to give us a taste of one case. But just before that, something that struck me, and I think we spoke about this in the original interview for the previous book, was the changing technologies. And the 60s through the 70s into the 80s probably saw as big a jump in maritime technology as maybe any other decades. As somebody who's a complete layman, I'm just looking at the Cold War era, submarines from the United States, Soviet Russia, and others, just grow generationally almost overnight with nuclear-powered submarines, with the missiles on board becoming more advanced, GPS comes into play, stealth technologies come into play. So all these different warships, and again, not the civilian side, but the military side, the water suddenly becomes a much more active place, a noisier place with all these signals and frequencies jumping about. Do you think that played a big part in the behavioral change of the phenomenon at the time?
I do. Yes, I do. I think you asked it very, very well. That's a really well way to put it. Good way to put it. Like if you think of where human civilization was in the year 1900, so 126 years ago, that was the year that we had the first operational submarine ever. So we go from there, first time we're going into the water. And of course, by today's standards, not a very effective submarine, but it was the first. And then shortly after that, we start developing sonar. During around the time of World War One, and then radio for out above water communication, and then World War Two, you start seeing large battleships and aircraft carriers, for the first time. And then in the 50s, nuclear submarines. I could stay under the water for months and months at a time. So our capabilities just radically changed in just 50 years. 50 years. So if you're them, you had to be thinking at the beginning of this period, we have full run of the waters. What can they do? They hardly have the ability to go under the water. And suddenly now they do, these humans. So it would have to cause an adaptive aspect to behavior if there is an intelligence that was down there all this time, which I think there was. So they've had to adapt. And I think they have to continue to adapt. Because now, I mean, I think the shift to nighttime operations, for example, one researcher pointed out to me, he said, well, yeah, it was in late 1960s that I think it was the Keyhole satellite developed a very advanced optical capability, particularly during daytime, like of exceptional resolution and practicality, but not so much at night. And I thought, oh, well, that I don't know if that is the answer, but that could be an answer. That could be one answer as to why the phenomenon seemed to go to nighttime observation, nighttime operations a little more often. I'm just guessing here, but I think the adaptive behavior of the non-human intelligences behind this has to be something we need to pay attention to. We're not the only society that's changing. They have to, if they are going to be here without us interrupting them, it's very likely they've had to make changes in their behavior as well. And I think it's possible to see those changes if we look carefully.
And is there any particular case through the research, through the time doing it, that either had a bit of a holy shit moment for you or totally blew your mind or you just did not expect to see in what you were working on?
One that I've actually discussed a number of times, but I think it's still worth repeating. Took aboard another aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy, in 1971. And we have this one, we've got the name of the primary witness and we have the exact date, July 2nd, 1971. I think the position of that ship was just north of Puerto Rico when you had a little after 8 in the evening, so it was still a little bit light. The ship goes to general quarters or battle stations. And according to the primary witness, he saw this himself. It was an orange glowing sphere that was seen just hovering above the ship, causing people really to freak out. A lot of the sailors were, screaming. One screamed into an intercom, "It's God, it's the end of the world." This was a very, very significant thing. The communications of the ship, the main witness was a comms specialist. So he said, just before I saw this object and just before the ship went into general quarters, all the communications coming in were just gibberish. So the communications were totally shut down. And they were shut down for about 30 minutes while this was going on. He only got to see the object for about a minute. And then that's when general quarters battle stations was announced and he had to go back to his communications station. So he didn't see how this object departed, but he learned that the weapon systems failed to function as well. So clearly they were trying to scramble aircraft. The aircraft would not start. This went on for about 25 to 30 minutes. You just imagine you're on a U.S. aircraft carrier. This is the American Empire's power projection right there. You know, those and nuclear submarines are what it's all about. And this big ship was out of communication for 30 minutes while this object just hovered over it, shutting off the weapon systems as well. I have to think, how would that not go to the president of the United States, who at the time was Richard Nixon? And I have no doubt. I have no doubt in my mind that President Richard Nixon would have been briefed on this. But it's just another drop in the bucket, just throw it in the pile, just another USO case. Now, this one, I don't know if this object emerged from the water or went into the water, but I had to include it. It was just, you're out at sea, this thing is low over the water, and it's directly over a US aircraft carrier. That has to go into the study. So I definitely included that one. But there were others. So I could toss out a couple of others that are not military.
I can say to you, for example, that that Lou Elizondo has conveyed to me the exact longitude and latitude down to the minute and second of the location off the Baja Peninsula in off Guadalupe Island, where they have actual videotape, gun camera videotape proof of UFOs coming to that particular site and plunging under the ocean with no splash at all, and traveling at from 200 to 400 miles an hour under the water down to some kind of location or site on the floor of the ocean right there. Okay. And now, so that when there are occasions when I will just declare that that's true, rather than saying, this is what has been conveyed to me, you know, by Lou Elizondo. But that it's not that I'm reluctant to do that, because Lou has conveyed that information to me. I haven't taken any national security oaths. I haven't signed any non-disclosure agreements. You know, and when Sean Kirkpatrick was interviewing me at Arrow and told me that I was restricted from being able to tell anybody where the interview took place or where their offices were, I've not conveyed to anybody where those offices are of Arrow. Okay, I respected that, but when he said that I shouldn't be talking to anybody about what it is that I've disclosed to them, you know, I respected that until Sean Kirkpatrick started to go public in asserting that they had not been provided any evidence of anybody being involved in direct UFO crash retrievals. You know, I gave him the names of people, you know, Clifford Stone, for example, that was directly involved in retrieval of these crash UFOs and the bodies of the beings there. And I gave Sean Kirkpatrick the name of these people. And what I noticed is that every time I got ready to give him a direct source of this, he would put down his pencil and stop taking notes so that there was like no record of the source that would somehow compel him to go talk to them, you know? And so I agreed to go public with that. And so I told him flat out that he's lying when he tells Congress that they've not received any information of any specific details of anybody who was involved in the crash retrieval program. He's just plain lying to them. And so I was not reluctant to say that. Lou had always had his security clearance. And in fact, the same thing is true of David Grush. You know, that what people didn't know, and I can reveal that one of the things that the challenge that was raised to the security clearance of Lou Elizondo and the challenge to the security clearance of Chris Mellon for having been the source of the information to the New York Times, the person who was assigned to review their security clearances and to determine whether or not they were going to continue to have their security clearances was David Grush. The people don't know that. When David Grush found out in his inquiry, because he was on the UAP task force in the Pentagon, right? He was from the National Reconnaissance Office. He was the liaison. He was the member of the Pentagon UAP task force from the National Reconnaissance Office. So he was selected to be the one to review their security clearances. And as soon as he learned that they had been specifically authorized by the Defense Department Office of Pre-Publication Security Review to reveal to the New York Times what they did, then he said, oh, good. All right. Then they're cleared. And he cleared their security clearance. That's when he started taking shit from everybody else involved in the Defense Department. Okay. So I went and met directly with, I'd had a number of conversations with Dave over the phones about that process, had recommended that he file the report with the director, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, about what was being done to him. And that's what Dave did.
Now there's rumor
I say rumour. A lot of folks would point to one of Gerb's major sources being David Grush. There seems to be a lot of people believing there's a Grush camp in the background and an Elizondo camp. You've spoken with both. You know both. You've consulted with both, if that's the correct word. Who would you believe right now would be best placed to head up that organization should it happen? Would it be Elizondo or would it be Grush?
My position is very clear as a lawyer that there should be no such board, period. There should be no board that is a pure executive branch appointed board. And therefore, both of them should decline to work for such a board, that Congress should create such a board of review. That's what has to be done. And the proper question then is, who should be the chief of staff for a congressionally authorized and subject to their review board of review, just like the Senate proposed in 2023 in the UAP Disclosure Act, and just exactly like the proposal that's now been made by Eric Burleson and put into the House version of the 2027 NDAA. That's what should happen. So that I would take the very clear, you know, it's like the question is like, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? You know, that's the wrong question as to who should be the head of this all executive branch controlled disclosure group, because then neither one of them should take that post. Now, it's going to be tempting. Either one of them might be offered that position to do that. But what they should do is take the position that, look, that I do not want to be disqualified from being the chief of staff for the congressionally overseen and congressionally approved members of such a review panel. And so, therefore, I would have to respectfully decline this self-serving offer that you guys are making to try to drag me into being part of the cover-up. Okay, and that would be the easiest way for Lou to exonerate himself to the extent to which he would, if he feels compelled to do so, you know, of being accused of being part of the cover-up. You know, that you certainly shouldn't become the chief of staff for some agency that is so conspicuously perceived by the whole public of being part of a setup, just like Arrow. You know, it's just like as if they were being invited to be the chief of staff of Arrow. You know, I mean, neither one of them should accept that position. So they need to be under the auspices of Congress. That's the constitutional body that needs to make these decisions about the disclosure.
So then Donald Trump tomorrow steps in and says, don't like this whole executive branch setup you're going for. It's going to be Congress. Let's have that happen. Who would you have lead the congressional one, Grush or Elizondo?
I would think that both of them should be there. There's no doubt about it. That Lou should be there and Dave Grush should be there. That they should be working, you know, together as directing that staff for Congress. But there needs to be other people there too, in positions of some authority, because both of these guys are going to be potentially attackable because they've signed these national security agreements, you know, and they've signed these non-disclosure agreements. As Lou has stated, you know, he has been specifically instructed that his non-disclosure agreement prohibits him from talking about crash retrievals. he's testified to that in Congress. So that you need that what we would need to do is get Congress to pass a law specifically releasing both Lou Elizondo and David Grush from any non-disclosure agreement that they had been forced to sign as a condition for them having access to the knowledge they have.
But it seems to be a fractured network of programs, contractors, agencies, different classification systems. You know, could the president, Congress, senior intelligence officials, you know, each possess different pieces of the story, think they have the whole story, but none of them actually have that complete oversight? Is that potentially what's happening here?
Well, it's a little bit different, Andy. Is that it's clear that there was such a definable group at one time, you know, that the President Truman very clearly, very soon after the wreckage at the Roswell, which has now been uniformly confirmed to be, to have happened, you know, that he did put together this group, whether you call it MAGIC or MJ-12 or whatever it was, you know, in the list of these people that I carry around in my day log, the names of all these people, you know, and we still are trying to figure out who the second generation of those people are, you know, and that David Grush has basically made reference to a couple of them, you know, Bobby Ray Inman, who's one of the present operatives of this, in the fact that Dick Cheney had been one when he was the vice president under Ronald Reagan, and he chaired the 5412 committee of the National Security Council. Okay, but that we know there's others, and we know people who know who they are. So there is in fact a remnant of that group still around. But the actual move that they're making right now is a little more subtle than that. And what's happening right now is they're trying to filter a lot of the technology that has been secretly developed under the aegis of this legacy group back in the 40s and 50s. They're trying to filter a lot of that technology into the United States Air Force and now into the U.S. Space Force, you know. And they've designed, for example, a new craft. It's called the S-47. It's a special fighter plane that's incorporating some of the technology that they've been successful in back engineering out of the UFO craft, and it's able to engage in combat operations in outer space. You know that it actually gets launched and it can maneuver in near orbit, and you see now that the Aero Office has been assigned a J3, a combat officer has been assigned to the Aero Office to coordinate intelligence information that's obtained by Aero to go directly to the U.S. Space Force, and that these people are all being trained out at Peterson Air Force Base out in Colorado, you know, and that there's a new group of people that they're trying to move in to have oversight control over this whole operation. And there's 27 of them. You know, I've got a list of them in my book right here. That's one. That sounds like McCarthy. You know, I've got, you know, 100 communists and I've got the list of them right here. But, you know, we know who these people are. And there's this major effort going on right now to try to shift control of this whole project out of this kind of rump group that has been assigned originally by Truman and appointed subsequently. Each one of those 12 men was authorized to handpick their own successor, okay? And so there was an entire second generation of these people have come into place, and some of the older ones of which are like Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, who's 93 years old now. You know, and they're hanging on just like Ruth Bader Ginsburg did on the Supreme Court. They're just hanging on, you know, and they're becoming, you know, weakened, you know, that group. But there's another group of people, this 27 group of people that are trying to move into place, and they're all retired people who are very high level U.S. government, executive branch people. You know, for example, the former commander of the United States Air Force's Department of Materiel. You have former directors of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. You have people who are the people in, for example, Lockheed Martin, executive vice presidents in charge of space development. You know, these people all retired. And they're in a major association that is attempting to assert coordinated control over this, you know, and they actually are in an association. There's a 501c3, a group that's that exists in Crystal City, just right near the Pentagon, and they have shadow offices out at Peterson Air Force Base out in Colorado, where they're actually training fighter pilots to pilot these new S-47 craft, these space fighters that they've got, that they're called, it's called the Tiger Group. the UAP space Tiger Group, you know. There's all that information that's around. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to kind of correlate it all together and make it clear what's going on here, that there is an effort to shift as much of this program inside the government as they can, because they think that that will immunize them against criminal prosecution under the Federal Criminal Racketeering Act. And I've been asked to prepare the complaint, the major Federal Criminal Racketeering Act complaint, to be lodged with Maine Justice in Washington to start identifying who these people are and what the kind of crimes are that more than just fraud, embezzlement. You know, they've embezzled literally trillions of dollars over the whole period of the program, you know, out of other appropriations. And they've skimmed money off other appropriations. And that's what they're doing. So that's what's really happening here, is there's an attempt to shift this program inside the government through this group of retirees and get the United States Space Command to take control of it.
Your shows often start with the clip that someone sent in a voicemail, and you get to hear someone's experience, their sighting. It can be pretty simple. It can be much more extreme. Where have you landed on what we're dealing with here? If folks come into this topic, Chris, with, are there aliens coming from other planets, yes or no, that quickly dissipates and you end up with something else. Where are you?
I don't know. I'm somewhere, like, it's tough to say. It really is tough, and I'm sure, you know, you're the same way. I spoke recently to Dr. Julia Mossbridge, and she had a great way of saying this. She's like, we're not just dealing with race cars in the sky, you know, and I think that I think that rings true for me as well. I think we get into this topic thinking we know a lot because we've heard about the grays, you know, and we're like, oh, it's the grays, you know, and like we have this sort of furrowed brow on how, you know, intelligent we are. And then the deeper you get, the more you realize I know nothing at all.
Jeff asks, what is the most outrageous sounding claim within the UFO topic that you suspect may actually be true?
Probably the underwater mobile construction unit.
Great answer.
That was on like 4chan.
Mm.
I suspect it. I'm pretty high conviction on that. Where I started off pretty low is like, oh, this is just some LARP. And funny enough, Gerb was someone who, you know, while talking to him, confirmed, as he put it, he had people with direct knowledge in the program that confirmed to him that all of that was pretty much true. Mm. Everything except like the submarine being obliterated. But he's like, everything else, every detail was absolutely true. And, you know, I don't let that be the only piece of information, but I do, because knowing Gerb's rigor when it comes to, you know, vetting his sources and getting information, doing research, I do let it raise my conviction level. And so that's one thing. But then if you look at so many other things, whether it's the craft that Bob allegedly worked on, Bob Lazar, which if you look at the inside of it, there's no kitchen, there's no bedrooms, it's three seats, that's it, built to spec. Matt Brown said something similar on his interview. He said these are made to purpose, which sounds an awful lot like built to spec, which was emphasized in this document. And you hear that over and over again. And so, and then you hear about all these sightings that happen in the trench or in the Bahamas, in the Catalinas, like all in the water, like with these giant USOs. And so it does, you know, start to help you piece together this world building view of everything. And so, yeah, I would say I'm pretty high conviction that there is something there. Love that question. That is great. Cause I ponder that as well. You think about people who want to know, want everyone to know. And then people who know want no one to know. Right. Yep. And that is like a really dark thought to think of. Cause now you're like, what on earth could you have been shown or told that makes you not want to tell anyone else, that makes you want to shut down and be like, no one can know of this. And there are probably several ways that you can take this, but I think one is probably tied to the container comment that Bob Lazar had when he read through some of these old documents, right? That we are all just containers. And now you think containers of what? Containers of blood, containers of food, container like wine. Do we age well, or is it like some type of soul container, or consciousness container? And if that's the case, then is there a way to control which container the soul goes into or where the soul moves? And so I think as soon as you talk about anything after death as having an answer, I think that's scary. Death itself frightens a lot of people because it's the unknown. But I think what's more frightening than the unknown is a certainty after death.
Mm.
That is very scary. To know where you're going and to know that there's no avoiding it, you can't not die. And then you're going into some giant recycle farm on the moon or something. I don't know. I think that's a terrifying thing.
Of all the people you've spoken to, you know, you're looking at your Travis Waltons, Bob Lazars, you know, take your pick of the UFO topic over the last, I've got your channel up to my left-hand side, over the last how many years, you've spoken to pretty much everyone you would want to. I'm sure you've got a few more on your bucket list. Who has been the most convincing for you that even as someone with that low conviction, you've heard them speak, and no matter what they've said, you've been like, this could be genuine, this could be true?
Mario Woods.
Okay. Do you want to just recap Mario's story? I've not spoken to Mario, but I know of him.
Yeah, 1977, I believe, Ellsworth Air Force Base. He was a sergeant he was Air Force Police working at one of these nuclear sites where they housed ICBMs. And he would basically, him and his partner, Michael Johnson, would have to patrol these different various nuclear sites along with so many other people. That's what they did. They just, you know, and he's on something called the PRP, the personal reliability program, which makes sure that like if you take any meds or if you're depressed or if you anything at all, you have to report it because you have to be absolutely of sound mind to be guarding nuclear missiles. That is just part of the job. So these people are without a doubt the finest, most capable people that you could produce, right? That's the whole plan. You're not going to have somebody who's unstable guarding nukes. So they're constantly tested, vetted, and all of this. He ends up patrolling with his partner, and they see this giant sphere hovering above one of these nuclear silos. Now, these things are out in the middle of nowhere in the desert, right? It takes, you know, miles to get there, and then they're there, and this thing is the size of what he claimed was a super Walmart, which is like a massive grocery store. It's huge, huge, roiling orb like the sun hovering 10 feet over this thing. He's in his car and they're frozen here. And the driver, Michael Johnson, is just holding the steering wheel. His eyes are wide open. He can't move. And all of a sudden they feel like this pressure, like the air is leaving their lungs and this blinding light. They start lifting. It's very strange. And he gets this smell, this overwhelming smell of like ammonia and sulfur. And all of a sudden he looks to, and he hears in his body, do not fear, do not fear, do not fear. Like this resonating sound in his body saying this. And he looks over and he sees a couple small beings and like a taller one, gray type beings, and passes out. Wakes up 8 miles away in the car, in the truck. His partner still holding the steering wheel, no recollection. They're radioing him. Where are you? Where are you? He's like, I don't know. I need emergency here for my partner. This is in December. December. There's a little bit of snow, a little bit of frost like in the desert, and no tracks, no tire tracks leading to where the car is. The car is just there. And they radio in and then they take him away and separate the two, debrief him for like 10 hours, of which Rick Doty was a part of that debriefing in 77, which is very interesting. he was in that room as like a junior OSI agent with his superior. And they do all sorts of weird tests to him and, you know, get him to write his testimony down over and over and over. And eventually Mario gets regressed and starts remembering a lot of what went on board. And one of the details, I think, is like the wildest detail for me, is Michael Johnson eventually shows up to his house and knocks on the door. They get to talking and Michael says, "I don't remember the beings, but all I remember is your glove laying on the shiny floor." And that detail, I was like, holy cow. Like, that paints a picture.
Mm.
You know, what shiny floor? Obviously, like some spaceship or whatever. And yeah, his story, when you listen to him talk, he's 71 and he is sharp as a tack. Just very, very heart-centered, fun to listen to, but also so profound. And that interview, that conversation for me was, I'm very high conviction on that. I would say that, and although I didn't interview them, I would say the witnesses of the Virginia case. I would say those are like two where like my conviction is like through the roof that happened. Yeah. Bob, I was always partial to because of, you know, just him being such a huge part of why I got into this topic as well. Meeting him off camera though, and talking to him, showing him things. I think I've mentioned this before, but like I talked to him about the underwater MCU stuff because they'd mentioned Bob Lazar in that document. Mentioned 115, they mentioned Bob Lazar. And I said, "Have you ever heard of this?" This is off camera, just me and him right here in the office. And he goes, "No, I never heard of that, you know?" And I said, "Yeah, they mentioned it." He goes, "What do they say?" And I regret telling him this because even then I was like, "Oh, why did I say this? A weird thing to tell him." But nonetheless, I said, "You know, at one point your name's mentioned because he's told that if your name is ever mentioned, they take you out back and they put you down like a dog." And Bob lost his footing. It was just me and him. And he like stumbled back, held onto my desk, and literally went, "Jesus Christ, oh shit." Oh, and you saw the fear, like a palpable, real fear in this man that like, oh, this isn't over. Like your name still invokes that type of reaction, meaning like you're still not safe potentially. Like there's like it scared him. I could tell. And that was a real, for me, on a personal level, that was like, oh shit, this isn't just a story to him. To me, this is LARP, this is suspend your disbelief, whatever.
Yeah.
Not to this guy. That's very real. And that raised my conviction about Bob. That interaction I had with him really changed how I saw everything. And I was like, oh, I gotta be careful of how I talk about this stuff with him. This is very real to him. With Travis, my conviction, I don't know. You're like, oh my God, this is happening. I can't believe this is happening right now. And when that happened to me the last time was during a waking meditation. And that's where I really went, oh my God, this is happening. Every other time was like in the middle of the night, right? So the next day you're like, did that really happen? Like, you know, you kind of convince yourself it didn't. But when the sun's shining in your room, you have a meditation, you put the headphones down, and the second you hit your head on the pillow, like there's no clicking out, there's no passing out. It's like, I'm here, I'm lucid, and then I start vibrating and I get out of my body. And I'm like, oh my God, I was just awake 3 seconds ago. Like there's no time between me being awake and now. So, and now I'm out of my body and walking around my room and looking at my body and terrified. I mean, like this is actually happening and the sun's shining. And so at that point, that really nudged me over the edge with like, okay, there's something here that I'm experiencing that is brand new. But the reason I haven't been pursuing it, I guess, would be a lot of people describe that state to be similar to the one they feel when they die.
Mm-hmm.
The out-of-body experience is often brought up by near-death experiencers to being similar. And so now that might not be what happens when you die. It might be transitional. It might be something. But it seems like this is the same phenomenon that we're experiencing when we die or when we almost die. And so I'm kind of like of the mind of like, what's the hurry? Right. Mm. If that is what happens, right? And I have experienced it. Great. Awesome. I'm going to do it again when I die. Why practice dying right now? Like, you know, if there is such thing as a soul, and if there is such thing as incarnation or whatever, if that is a thing, then we gave that up for this somehow at some stage, right? We gave up eternal whatever, bliss, manifestation, all this is loving, whatever, light. We gave all that up to like live in the mud here. And in the trenches, right? Why? This has to mean something then. It has to be way more important than whatever that is. And if this is just transient, like enjoy the body, dude. Enjoy the fun. Enjoy the meals, the air, you know? And stop. Once you've had that confirmation, I would say, what's the point? Why would you want to die so early all the time?